Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia. You know, our goal with these podcasts is to find fascinating guests who educate me, inspire me, promote me to think more, try more, do more, be more. And hopefully you feel the same about our guests. Well, today we have a guest who ticks all those boxes. Dr. Babak Kateb is a veritable force of nature, a man who has a tireless drive to make a difference, and boy, is he making a huge difference. The good doctor was educated at the Tulane University School of Medicine in New Orleans, Louisiana, the University of Southern California, or USC, in Los Angeles. His research fellowship was at the USC Keck School of Medicine in the Department of Neurosurgery, and he also studied very large-scale integration systems. I'm going to have to ask him what that means, at USC's Department of Electrical Engineering at the Ming-Hsi Institute. Babak Kateb is a neuroscientist with more than 20 years of research experience focused on advanced diagnostics and therapeutics into clinical neuroscience to rapidly identify and introduce game-changing technologies to treat malignancy, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and other brain and spinal disorders. Babak was Director of Research and Development in the Department of Neurosurgery at City of Hope Comprehensive Cancer Center, where he collaborated with NASA to develop new means of treating cancer. And while there, he received NASA's Tech Brief Award for his pioneering work on sniffing cancer cells. At my old stomping ground, Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles, he again worked with NASA to develop ultraviolet imaging for intraoperative brain mapping, and also patented an FDA-approved microwave technology to treat various cancers, not just neurosurgical cancers. Babak established the Society for Brain Mapping and Therapeutics, or SBMT, while doing his research fellowship 15 years ago at USC. And currently, he's the founding chairman of the board of directors and the CEO of the SBMT. He's president and scientific director of the Brain Mapping Foundation and director of the National Center for Nanobioelectronics. He's been recognized by then Vice President, now President Biden, the mayor of Los Angeles, the governor of California, and many others for his dedication to science. You wouldn't think that he has any spare time, but somehow he fits in being an exhibited artist. He does medical illustrations. He's also an 18-time marathon runner and a thoroughly nice bloke. Professor Babak Kateb, welcome.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, for having me on this fantastic podcast. Appreciate it.
Well, I think the pleasure and the privilege is mine. So let's, as the song says, let's start at the very beginning. You've had a long and illustrious career in the United States, but you were born overseas. Tell us about that and how your early life influenced your current life.
Well, I mean, I have to go back, way back in years that I was raised in a military family. My father was one of the top officers and generals of the Shah, and he disciplined us in the family and really told us to focus on outcome. Discipline ourselves to execute what we always plan to do. So I'm raised in that type of family, and the outcome matters for me. And I also had a fortunate experience of war. If you remember, during Iran-Iraq war.
Yes, of course. There have sadly been quite a few.
Yeah, so at the age 17, I was basically sent to the war, and I was a combat medic at that time nearby Basra. And basically grew up pretty fast. So after my training in the Tehran U, and I left Iran as a political refugee, came to U.S. and basically jump-started and restarted my career here.
So how old were you when you arrived on American shores?
I was 24.
Mm-hmm. 24. It's probably a pretty tough time to come. Mind you, I guess you'd had a grounding of being in the military, but tough time to come, right?
Correct. Well, you know, I think what I did at that time, I could not put up with the nonsense of the regime, and I left the country to pursue my future career in the United States.
Well, and you've done amazingly, and we're very pleased to have you on this side of the divide. So I did mention in my introduction, you know, normally when I learn about someone, I'll do my reading, but I could not understand what I was reading about large-scale integration system design. I did look up the Ming-Hsi Institute and how that had been endowed with a $35 million gift. But tell us about what is very large-scale integration and how does a neuroscientist get to play in electrical engineering? I am baffled.
Well, at the Department of Neurosurgery at Cedars-Sinai, we kind of decided to work on new therapeutics for brain cancer. And the current therapies for brain cancer include radiation and some laser ablation, but we thought that laser ablation could actually play a significant role in a future treatment of cancer because it has less side effects. So I had to basically go back to USC and, train and basically learn how to design as a microwave ablation system, which later on we got an FDA approval and kind of turn it to a product and try to spin it off to a company.
So there was method in madness, right? So understanding electrical energy. I always love these links, these sort of historical links and how our thinking changes all the way from, you know, Galvani utilizing electricity and demonstrating that tissue could be animated by electrical energy. So I guess you were doing the same with a little bit more finesse, shall we say. So let's come on to talk about the Society for Brain Mapping. It's your baby. How do you see this group in, well, look, there's a very, very crammed academic society network. There are multiple, there's more societies than you can shake a stick at. Where does the Society for Brain Mapping and Therapeutics fit in?
Well, I started this out of my fellowship at USC. So I back in 2003, I was doing my kind of research fellowship at neurosurgery department at Keck School of Medicine. At the same time, I was at NASA JPL as a visiting scientist at Caltech. So this is around the time that the first Mars rover was up there. And if you remember, got stuck to a rock, they couldn't move it. So on the same day, we had a symposium of about 8 people at NASA JPL. And it was funny that we were, you know, going in as a delegation and people thought that we are coming from the NASA headquarters to solve the problem. So the cameras were following us. So, basically, we brought scientists of different background, molecular biology and so on from Caltech, and neurosurgeons, as well as rocket scientists together to just, you know, kind of discuss what is possible by crossing discipline and what are the issues we deal with in the world of clinical neuroscience. So that summit gave birth to a symposium. So we started a series of lectures and the next year at the USC Keck School of Medicine, and then grew faster and faster to become an independent nonprofit when the war started. So I thought that there's a great need for creating a foundation for soldiers with traumatic brain injury, because I had experienced my own experience with the war, and also started a medical association, 501c6, to cross discipline. And you're right, there are many societies out there, but most societies focus on reimbursement of physicians. Most societies are focused on just kind of a basic advocacy for the members, but we are advocating for better science, fast-tracking therapeutics and diagnostics, translating and commercializing neurotechnologies. So basically, from a small summit, we turned this to a global organization. Now it has thousands of members, and this year we have 900 presenters at the convention. We have taken over half of the LA Convention Center, and we have cadaver labs and also for brain and spine. And we got into policy, so...
Well, I want to dig into each of these things and get a wee bit more granular in a second, but... You know, it seems like sometimes, what's that wonderful quote that to the uninitiated, any significantly advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic? I think it's Arthur C. Clarke, and I think I've just slaughtered the quote. But, you know, I'm sure there were people who were naysayers when you started this. What are you thinking of bringing together all these disparate people? How does that work?
Yeah. I remember that call from one of the, basically, I think he was a kind of a vice chairman, asked me to call him. So I pick up the phone and he screamed at me saying that, who the hell you think you are? You're just a fellow here and you're organizing this event at Keck. It's the dean and a vice dean and top scientists. You should have told me. I said, Professor, you are invited.
Yeah, well, you know, again, if something's disruptive, the good thing about medicine is that we are inertia-bound. Being inertia-bound is good because it stops us doing daft things, but it's bad because it means when something truly paradigm-shifting comes along, we're resistant. You know, look at people like Marshall with Helicobacter pylori. You know, peptic ulcers are caused by bacteria. Don't be ridiculous. They're caused by stress or too much acid or whatever. And then in retrospect, well, of course, it was bloody obvious, wasn't it?
Indeed.
You've established a number of awards through your society. I know some luminaries like Stephen Hawking was among the list. So tell us a little bit about the awards, who you've honored, what does that achieve other than, of course, making the recipient feel good, of course?
Of course, yeah. I mean, I think... You know about Oscars and Emmy Award and Grammys. I think the society needs to understand who are the pioneers who are saving lives. So we couldn't do this for all disciplines, but we could at least do it for the field of neuroscience. So the awards are meant to shed light on pioneering work and, either on the policy side, technology development and medicine, or people who have done an incredible work to raise awareness about neurological disorders. In this case, Stephen Hawking was really a beacon of courage and dedication to show, despite of his disabilities, he's a superior being and it's a very, very capable person. So we basically started a series of awards. One is Pioneering Medicine Award given to scientists and physicians who discover new diagnostics and therapeutics. The other one is Pioneering Technology Development goes to the CEO of the companies that develop new techniques and technologies. Pioneering Healthcare Policy goes to congressional leaders, member of Parliament of Canada and Australia have received it in the past. And who basically shed light on neurological disorders, psychiatric disorders, and past policies to help people. Then we have Young Investigator Awards for Young Scientists and Student Awards. And basically, this is a way to raise these individuals' profile, highlight their work, the importance of the work that they are doing, the impact of their work, and in a sense, glorify science.
Well, it's I think it's an amazing slate of awards and an amazing slate of people, and it shows how the imprimatur of your society is growing. So there's a meeting coming up in Los Angeles, July the 8th to the 11th, 2021. It's been a massive undertaking, and you said 900 speakers, and it's a mix of in-person and virtual. Given the continued difficulties due to COVID, have you faced organizing this? And what if you had an aspirational goal for the meeting? What would you want it to accomplish? What would you want people to be saying 6 months, a year afterwards?
Well, I mean, I think the meeting is set to achieve several goals. The annual meeting of Society for Brain Mapping and Therapeutics bring a multidisciplinary group of scientists, engineers, surgeons of different backgrounds together. In order to fill up the gap of education exists between different disciplines. So as the biological and physical disciplines grow, the gap of education between these disciplines grow further. So we are trying to fill up the gap of education between a rocket scientist and a neurosurgeon. What does a rocket scientist know that neurosurgeon doesn't, and vice versa, or neurologist and radiologist and physicist and molecular biologist with psychiatrists and so on. So in our gap analysis with Johns Hopkins University Office of Continuing Medical Education and St. Louis University of Continuing Medical Education, we basically clearly stated that, and the goal of the convention is to fill up that gap of education while providing CME accreditation. Other goals including basically advocating for policies that are going to be game-changing, including the establishment of what's called the Brain Technology and Innovation Park.
I'm going to come on to that. So I guess let's lead into that. You're planning to build a neuro-based science park in LA. It's not a minor undertaking by any means. Expand on that, and we'll come on to policy in a bit.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think what is very important is we fast-track therapeutics and diagnostics for neurological disorders. The pace that we have been at is really not acceptable. And the COVID-19 experience, as harsh as it has been, shown us that we can come together very quickly and put competitions aside. In this case, Merck helped Johnson & Johnson and vice versa to fast-track therapeutics, get vaccines to the arms, and solve the problem. I think the whole system of grant-making in NIH or equivalent agencies in UK and other part of the world encourage competition between scientists, which in my opinion is not helping us to solve problems such as brain cancer and Parkinson, Alzheimer, because I have to show I'm better than you are to be able to get the money to do my research. But what if we do a paradigm shift here? What if we say, everybody work together and solve the problem of brain cancer? Everybody work together and solve the problem of Alzheimer. And here's the funding for a consortium. Go build your consortium, and these consortiums will work in lockstep together to solve a problem. In that case, you could easily find solutions more rapidly. So, but there's another angle to this. If you look at all the universities in UK and Europe or US, we have thousands of patents sitting on the shelf collecting dusts. These are ideas that are written about, you got funding for it, and proven to be pure and really very good ideas. But the process stops there. What if we create a bridge from the patents on the shelves to products in the clinics. So what the Brain Technology Innovation Park going to do, bring private equity funds, venture capital groups, family offices with the government agency funding and nonprofits to fast track therapeutics and diagnostics.
So I want to come back to policy in a second and talk a little bit about some of your specific work. You did work with NASA and the Los Alamos Labs involving the use of artificial intelligence. And I want to come back to AI in a minute. Augmented reality, virtual reality, supercomputing for brain mapping and therapeutics, advanced ultrasonic technology for brain stimulation. The brain is clearly our next medical frontier. And you've put together learned tomes on topics like nano neuroscience and nano neurosurgery. I'm not sure I could write a sentence on those things. So tell us, all the areas that you've played in, what are your best bets on what are going to be the spaces to watch?
I think I would say nanobioelectronic, because you will see more integrative approach to therapeutics of the future. Take Pfizer's vaccine. Pfizer vaccine is an mRNA, molecularly developed vaccine. But this is wrapped in a nanotechnology envelope, okay? So you're going to see more and more integration of nano platforms for drug delivery with other, you know, molecular structures. You're going to see more vaccine therapy for cancers in the future, now that the mRNA has shown to be, you know, fantastically, you know, superior to any other types of vaccine development. And but then you also see integration of nanotechnology with cellular therapeutics and imaging. So, I mean, today actually I'm doing pre-recording keynote for World Stem Cell Summit to tell them that a stem cell is not a silver bullet, but when you integrate it with other platforms, then you can use it as a much more better therapy. To give you an example, one of the problems with stem cell is that when you inject millions of them into the body, you can't track them. Well, that problem could be solved with nanoparticle, and we could have magnetic nanoparticle put into these cells, and then you inject the cells to the body, and then you can use MRI to track them. So that's called a nanobioelectronic approach, because the nano part is the nanoparticle, bio part is the cellular therapeutics, electronic part is basically, in this case, MRI, you know. So the future of medicine is really integration of different disciplines come together as a drug or device.
And that's why a meeting and an approach such as yours makes perfect sense. I'm called to mind the Stanford biodesign approach, where rounds on hospital patients include basic scientists and, you know, all sorts of folks who will have a different perspective. That, you know, I commend you for that. So we've mentioned legislation a couple of times, and you've been deeply involved in global neuroscience legislation through close collaboration with the United States Congressional Neuroscience Caucus, as well as members of the Canadian Parliament. What would you like governments around the world to do in relation to neuroscience, other than, of course, fund this park you're going to build?
That's a great question. We tend to think that funding usually solves our problem. But if you take a look at the amount of money spent in neuroscience, and European Union has put $1 billion in the EU Brain Project, and US has put almost similar amounts into the Brain Initiative, which, by the way, I was involved in with many other scientists, but we, as an organization, involved in formulation and execution of that. And I was at the White House when the President Obama announced the Brain Initiative. So at that time, I told one of the top advisors, Phil Rubin, that our problem is not lack of money. Our problem is poor coordination and execution of funds. So I think we are publishing a paper actually on the topic that why we have failed in the field of neuroscience. Is it money? I don't think so. There are plenty of money, billions of dollars out there. But what is it? It's, I think, in my opinion, lack of data sharing this kind of a, I would say, human greed that I need to get there first to discover something versus, again, coming together and solving a problem that cannot be solved by one individual alone. So the policies that we have advocated in last several years, including my presentation at the Canadian Parliament and Australian Parliament, has been focused on formation of brain initiatives to the G20 summit called Neuroscience 20, which covers brain, spine, and mental health. And the focus of it is also crossing disciplines and fast-tracking therapeutics in the process, basically creating jobs.
Right. So another topic that was mentioned a little bit earlier is AI, artificial intelligence. Elon Musk, who has an opinion about many things, has repeatedly warned that artificial intelligence will soon become just as smart as humans, and that when it does, and you know, you're thinking about applying it to healthcare, when it does, we should all be scared, very scared, because humanity's very existence will be at stake. So you're talking, you know, as you were talking about nano bioelectrics, and I'm thinking about all the crazy conspiracy theories that have circulated about vaccines. I think as a profession, we've done a poor job educating the lay public about vaccines. We've allowed these nonsensical theories to abound. But then in the background, you've got artificial intelligence and you've got people like Elon Musk saying, look out. How do we control this? Does AI pose a threat if we're not cautious and careful? What do you think?
Yes, I mean, I think my dear friend Stephen Hawking also said the same thing. And I think I should agree with them both. We have to have series of guardrails, as we do in many other disciplines. We have to make sure that the ethics of what we are doing here is right, especially on the medical side. And as scientists, we have to do a better job of educating public about what's happening in light of the COVID-19. Which, by the way, it impacted my own family. My own mother was in the ICU last year. This time, she was in the ICU at Cedars-Sinai. I had 25 doctors, plus myself on her. We saved her, but I mean, she went through ARDS. She went to sepsis, encephalitis, acute hypercoagulable state, autonomic dysfunction, and variety of different issues, but we saved her because we could predict, prevent, and treat. That prediction was very important because I knew that we're going to be dealing with ARDS. I knew we're going to be dealing with the cytokine storm. So, and then we intervened exactly at the right time. So we didn't use AI, computer, but that's the AI approach, right? So I think being able to predict pattern of cancer growth is one of the work that we have done with supercomputers, now working with Oak Ridge National Lab and with Lawrence Livermore National Lab. So yeah, I think the future of cancer therapy or therapy for neurological disorders using machine learning is bright. But again, we have to have guardrails. You can't just have a hodgepodge approach to this. And once you have a good data, and a good data means a data that you acquire it properly, you share the data properly and on time, and you store it properly. Okay, so if you have a good data like that, then you can look at the population of Alzheimer's patients and look at the behavior and response to certain treatment, and basically adjust your therapeutic approach, or brain cancer or spinal disorder and so on. So on one side, very promising, we can see it. And I mean, we use that AI approach to treat our patients. I'm sure you do the same thing, Jonathan. You predict things, you prevent them. And that's intelligence. That's not artificial intelligence. So you can apply the same thing in a bigger data set, which requires a computer, so we can call it AI. But at the same time, we have to be careful that the ethics of this is under control.
Yeah. I mean, there are some operating principles. You know, I'm clearly a fan of science fiction, because I'm going to quote another author, Isaac Asimov, who had created these rules of robotics, that robots can't harm people. And it was a sort of an ethical approach to it. And, you know, developing a machine learning algorithm, AI behind it, so that you can examine massive data sets and see associations that otherwise you wouldn't see, is great. It's when you put the machine in charge of turning ventilators on or off that issues arise. So I just think it's a mixture of making sensible decisions and communicating them properly, and not being sort of part of the elite. And I think scientists, physicians have had a habit of doing that. We know better than you, just listen to us. And it's the stuff of science fiction movies, so we shouldn't do that. So my final question, Babak, I'm going to ask you to imagine that you're walking along a Santa Monica beach, and it's just before the sun is just starting to come up, and you stub your toe and you look down and there's an old bottle in the sand. You pick it up, you give it a rub, and out pops a genie and grants you 3 wishes for the world. What would Dr. Babak Kateb wish for?
Wow, that's a difficult, you got me on the spot. What do I wish for? I wish health for everybody, because if you are healthy, you're wealthy. Okay, so health is your wealth. So, and second wish is obviously my own experience in life dealing with wars. I hope that we solve our problems without anger and without destruction, but through discussions and collaboration. And the third wish is that we get our brain park, because that's going to be a game changer for neuroscience.
Well, having seen what you've done thus far, I have zero doubt that you will achieve this. You are, like I said at the beginning, you're a force of nature. I just want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us today, and for all you do to push the boundaries of what we know. Thank you so much.
Thank you, my friend. And I thank your audience, fantastic audience, for giving me this honor to be on your show. Needless to say that you yourself are a force of nature. So it's an honor to be on this show.
Well, I'll accept that if you're a tornado, I'm a little breeze. So folks, if you want to learn more about the amazing work our guest does, please check out www.worldbrainmapping.org. That's www.worldbrainmapping.org. And we will put a link up on the website where the podcast is archived. So that's it for today. Please join me, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, next Friday for the next edition of the EMG Health Podcast. Until then, stay safe, stay well, and stay curious. Bye for now.